This is The Mary Davis Show, a program that takes an inside look at what is happening in Western New York with interviews, news, special features, and the community calendar. Now, here is your host, Mary Davis.
Good morning and welcome. I'm your host, Mary Davis. The show, of course, as you all know at this time of the morning, is The Mary Davis Show. And my guest this morning in a one-on-one is with Gary Earl Ross. Now, Gary is Professor Emeritus at SUNY, a certain branch of SUNY. I think it's the
Educational Opportunity Center.
And Gary is also a published author. He's a playwright. He's a public speaker, which and has known quite well around Buffalo, and had an article just recently, or was featured in an article recently, I should say, in the Buffalo News. So we're talking this morning about something that I think is quite important, and that's the legacy of Abraham Lincoln, who passed through Buffalo 150 years ago. And although that might seem like a lot in history, it's not even a blink as far as history goes. But I contend, and Gary doesn't quite agree with this, that when we come to Lincoln and we talk about the Civil War, I think that the North won a battle, but the South won the war. And this is, I'm talking in with regard to race relations in this country, which we're seeing things that are, particularly when I think about what's going on with the police now, it reminds me of the old paddy wheelers, I think they were called, paddy rollers.
Paddy rollers, yes.
That used to patrol the South, basically to make sure they kept blacks in check. And any white person, usually, of course, men, could stop any black person, man, woman, or child, for any reason whatsoever, and demand a show of papers, or where have you been, different information, and could literally do anything to you as well. And it reminds me right now of what we're seeing a lot of today. We have the driving while black, driving while Muslim now, but mainly started with driving while black. And that means you could be stopped for what? And the last person that was shot, I think, in the country, I'm not sure the state right now, was stopped for what was he doing? The man was in his car. In fact, he was the one was shot in his driveway, basically speaking, and accused of wanting to know what car he was driving, and police thought it was stolen. But he kept saying, I'm in my driveway. This is my drive. This is my house. I'm here. So this is my contention. I think Gary may have some other opinions. Gary?
I do have some other opinions. I don't think the South, quote, won the war. I think the war for racial equality is a long-standing war. It's not definitively won. However, the two-time election of Barack Obama suggests to me that a significant portion of the country is beyond its racial bias. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that a significant portion doesn't hang on to a racial bias. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that racial bias will manifest in some things, like some of the police situations we've seen recently. Mm-hmm. But the flip side of that is that police do a very difficult job, and I have a son who is a police officer. Mm-hmm. And there are circumstances where they have to make split-second decisions. Now, the police officer who stopped a man, an unarmed man who was running away, mm-hmm. By dropping into a two-handed shooter stance and mm-hmm. unloading eight bullets mm-hmm. toward his back, I think five of which
struck him.
Mm-hmm. That was homicide. That was not some life or death decision mm-hmm. that he had to make.
That's flat out murder.
That's flat out murder. Let's mm-hmm. contrast that with a case in Arizona last week, where a police officer in a car ran a man down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when I first saw the video of that on the news, I thought, "This
Yikes.
Is insane."
Mm-hmm.
But then I saw another dash cam video online and heard the first police officer saying, you don't want to do that, you don't want to do that, to a man who had stolen a rifle and ammunition from Walmart,
mm-hmm.
who had done a home invasion and who was walking down a residential street
mm-hmm.
toward a business area
mm-hmm.
firing shots.
Mm-hmm.
The policeman in the car, in the second police car, calculated that if they tried to stop the man by surrounding him and engaging in a gunfight,
mm-hmm.
bullets could fly everywhere and other people could get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
He thought the most efficient way to stop this man who had committed crimes and was in the process of discharging a firearm was mm-hmm. to hit him with his car.
Mm-hmm.
And the district attorney in that particular town in Arizona, and I understand it's a town that's had some issues.
Mm-hmm.
The suspect was Latino.
Mm-hmm.
The district attorney has not filed charges.
But it was a 2,000-pound car.
It was a 2,000-pound car. But the man was discharging a firearm mm-hmm. publicly in broad daylight walking down the street.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that decision is different from, say, the police officer choking Eric Garner to death.
Yes.
That's
mm-hmm.
that's a totally different circumstance. That was one where the man posed an obvious threat to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
The man who was running away from the police officer unarmed, the man in another part of South Carolina who stopped in a gas station several months back
mm-hmm.
and got shot while reaching for his wallet, as he had been instructed to do, and that
mm-hmm.
cop is in jail right now on an attempted murder charge. Those mm-hmm. things, those are not justifiable actions
mm-hmm.
the same way. I mean, so you can have a debate about some things that police do and not about others. The one case where the reserve police officer of 73 decides to tase a man who has already been brought down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, essentially, this guy is Grandpa doing a ride-along, which was me mm-hmm. a few weeks ago when mm-hmm. I was visiting my son in
He's
Florida.
He's playing cop, basically.
He's playing cop. My son's sergeant took me on a ride-along.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my business to get involved in those things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why this guy is doing a ride-along as a reserve police officer armed with a taser and a sidearm.
They said he sort of bought his way there. I mean, he did a lot of favors for
right,
the sheriff's
yeah.
department.
Well, there's that, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
That was just wrong. And then he offered an apology on television. It was, I'm sorry to this family because this is the worst moment of the second worst moment of my life because I had cancer, but I got over it. And he started mm-hmm. talking about all these other things. I'm thinking, pal, this has nothing to do with
what your personal
this isn't
health.
About you.
Mm-hmm.
You killed a man.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you killed a man who didn't deserve to die. He was on the ground. He was cuffed. He had already been subdued. Why would you even tase him?
Well, the first thing that came to my mind in that particular case was the taser is a bright yellow instrument. It's rather difficult not to see, I would say.
The difference in weight is marked.
It's on different parts of your body. And if you've been used to this and trained on this, you would sort of know, no, my taser's on the left, the gun is on the right, or whatever.
Yes.
I tend to not... I think that it was a case of being able to play cop and I can pull out a gun and I can do this, that, or the other type of thing. Maybe he did not mean to kill the man, but he certainly meant to shoot him.
I don't think he intended to kill the man. I think he honestly thought he was taking his taser. I will take him at his word for that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not something he needed to do. I mean,
no,
he's playing cops and robbers. And
I think the sheriff's department, basically. Now, I don't have a thing about there are a lot of senior people who are very agile, very bright, and can certainly continue learning in Equal Opportunity Center or that you went to, you probably saw senior people there.
I'm a senior person, Mary. I retired.
You know,
I was Grandpa on the ride. I mean, comedians are making the jokes. Whose idea was it to take Grandpa on a ride along? Well, I'm Grandpa, and I recently did a ride along, and that's okay. I had no authority to act.
But what I'm saying is, sometimes that job it's like playing baseball or football or basketball. Sometimes you have to your body has to be maybe younger, your physical condition may happen to be younger, and maybe your reflexes have to be a little sharp. You can't dispute, no matter how sharp you may be as you're getting on in age,
mm-hmm.
sometimes your reflexes aren't what they were when you were 20.
Oh, absolutely.
And maybe your ability to learn things aren't as sharp as they were when you were 16, 17, 18, 19, to learn. Mm-hmm. I'm only saying that perhaps this was not the right situation for someone to be who's basically speaking an insurance executive or insurance salesman to be running around doing a job which does call for a lot of physical fitness, I would say, and mental agility.
It does. And not only that, it calls for a judgment that you have to exercise every day on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, and I write mystery stories, crime stories. I have police friends. I have a son who's a police
mm-hmm.
officer. And I'll tell you, by contrast, my son David made a choice recently, some months back. He had been called because a man stole $55 in merchandise from Walmart in the Florida town where David's a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
He pursued the guy,
mm-hmm.
got him face down. He was not face down. He faced him down in a corridor. The guy couldn't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And David says, "You're under arrest." But this is not. It was $55 worth of merchandise.
Mm-hmm.
The procedure would have been, give the guy an appearance ticket, take the merchandise back to the store. It's mm-hmm. a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
The guy decided to fight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, David ratcheted up the situation.
He
ratcheted it up. Now, mm-hmm. David's a three-time combat veteran of Iraq mm-hmm. And, you know, a marksman.
mm-hmm.
He did not pull his gun.
Mm-hmm.
It was a threat to him, but mm-hmm. he's in very good shape.
Mm-hmm.
He brought the guy down, but in the process of doing that, injured his shoulder and needed mm-hmm. surgery. And it was his right shoulder. His mm-hmm. right hand is a gun hand. He's been off the street for a long time now. He's still recovering from the surgery. He's probably got maybe four or five weeks to go before he can mm-hmm. go back to work. Well, the situation got crazy. It could have gone worse mm-hmm. for him,
mm-hmm.
But he made the decision that it is not worth shooting this person mm-hmm. for that. And the guy, instead of taking the appearance ticket, and I mean, apparently he was jacked on coke,
mm-hmm.
But the guy, he's already been tried and sentenced, and
well,
he's gotten 3 years in prison.
The drug thing was
an issue, but he's gotten 3 years in prison on what was initially just going to be a misdemeanor, and it mm-hmm. didn't need to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So police are in situations like that, and they have these. They have to make these decisions. So every case is a different circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
We can see the ones that are glaringly obvious. Eric Garner, mm-hmm. the gas station shooting. This particular guy with the suspect running away. I think in that you saw the first dash cam thing. The suspect got out of the car or met the cop. The cop went back to the car to check. The guy ran.
Mm-hmm.
So the cop chased him. They tussled, struggled, whatever. The guy ran again after he had been tased, and the cop said, "I'm in his head, basically, you know, I'm tired of chasing this guy," and he mm-hmm. pulled out his gun and mm-hmm. shot. That was his human failing,
something,
and he's
like
going to
Indiana
pay for that.
Indiana Jones did this one thing.
Well,
this
yeah.
one thing. He
yeah.
he looked down there for his gun, didn't have it, and said, "Uh-oh." You know,
Well, the other thing the guy did was walk over to the body, apparently,
mm-hmm.
if you look at the tape or the video, and drop his taser to support his claim that the guy had his taser. Well, the guy
yes.
didn't have his taser.
Mm-hmm.
So he's fabricating evidence
yeah.
in the process of doing this. And that whole thing was just very, 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 very shaky. So
mm-hmm.
this guy is going away as he should. And
mm-hmm.
and this is a justified murder charge.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a lawyer. I've just written courtroom dramas. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I'm not a cop. I've just written mystery stories. But
mm-hmm.
my sense of right and wrong tells me that this mm-hmm. was not a justifiable shoot
mm-hmm.
By any stretch.
And not shoot somebody in the back like that.
And no, the mm-hmm. Supreme Court, stare decisis, which mm-hmm. means settled law or settled decision.
Mm-hmm.
Stare decisis, the Supreme Court already said you can't shoot a suspect running away
mm-hmm.
unless he poses a danger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he had been running away with a gun,
mm-hmm.
if he had gotten a gun from somewhere and was running away, the police would have been totally justified to shoot
mm-hmm.
him at that point.
Mm-hmm.
If he had gotten the taser
mm-hmm.
and was running away with that,
mm-hmm.
he would have been justified in shooting him.
Mm-hmm.
This cop was mad because the guy was running.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, he drew his weapon
mm-hmm.
calmly.
Mm-hmm.
And dropped into what is called the two-handed shooter stance
mm-hmm.
and took aim at center mass, the
mm-hmm.
you know, between the neck
mm-hmm.
and the waist basically,
mm-hmm.
because that's the biggest target on a human being.
Mm-hmm.
It's called a center mass shot. You're trained to shoot. I know people say, "Why didn't he shoot him in the leg?" Because it's hard to shoot in a leg. If you've ever gone to a pistol range or you've ever fired a gun,
mm-hmm.
you know the bullet doesn't always go exactly where you want it to go. That's
mm-hmm.
that's a movie myth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you aim for the biggest target because that's the one you're likely to hit. And he
mm-hmm.
got the guy. He shot him, I think he unloaded.
Five times he was shot.
He unloaded eight shots.
Mm-hmm.
He hit him in the back, I believe.
Five times.
Four times and clipped his ear with one.
Mm-hmm.
So what shows you there's a difference between center of the back and
mm-hmm.
the ear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a space
mm-hmm.
difference. Because.
And then didn't even try to, the other cops coming out didn't even try to help. I think to me it's just a lack of humanity. And I still say that when
yes.
it comes to race, we talked about this before, that there's something in the culture, in the American culture, among the majority of people, that really, after 150 years, simply cannot see, particularly black people, as legitimate.
As legitimately human.
Well, yes. Or in certain other citizens of the United States, as we can witness with Barack Obama. And then someone else, I'm not sure if it was you, Gary, or someone else I was discussing this with, mentioned the fact of what would have happened if suddenly there were simply no black people in the United States.
Well, there was a book written in the 30s by George Schuyler called Black No More. It was a satire where somebody in a lab cooked up a cure for blackness. And all the black people said, I'm out of here, and started drinking that particular Kool-Aid to turn white. And then it became fashionable to be black, to be different and unusual, so people started drinking another thing to reverse the process.
But I guess what he was saying is, or the, of this conversation with, that they would have to be, Americans need somebody to dislike.
Yes.
We just need somebody.
Every human society has an other. In America, it tends to be people of color, mainly black, Native American, and to a lesser degree, Asian, because you think of the Chinese Exclusion Acts of the 19th century, because, you know, you can come build the railroad, but we don't want you to be citizens and other things like that.
But then he said, and the thought to me, if you read even Buffalo's history, there were some major battles when there weren't that many black people in Buffalo and around him.
Absolutely.
Between Italians and Irish.
Yes.
Because there were no blacks to put this hate on. So it was transferred between those two. Because they didn't dare do it to the Germans, I don't think,
no,
or the English.
If you read books from the 19th century or The Mismeasure of Man by Stephen Jay Gould, which is a wonderful book that outlines phony social science of the 19th century and how that tried to establish a racial hierarchy. If you read that, you'll see the English are number one. The Germans are number two. And you start playing around with other areas of Europe and you start to go down the line. You're considerably lower when you get Spanish, Italian, and Greek. And you go lower when you get people like Slavic peoples.
Don't forget Sicilians, because they're a little bit lower than Italians.
They were lower than the Italians, right. But if you look at that hierarchy that they set up in the 19th century and you keep going down, then you get Native Americans, and then, quote-unquote, Negroids, the Negroid people of Africa. And you get them ranked, and you get Asians. And so the people who set it up were people of English descent in America who were saying, well, we are number one. And then they move right down the line, categorizing the value of everyone else. And that has been part of our history in this country of using false science. For example, in The Mismeasure of Man, Gould reports things that they did with studies of crania, cranial studies indicating that the European male, the English, had a larger cranial capacity than the German, that had a larger cranial capacity than the next person on the list. And they measured the capacity by putting buckshot in and weighing things. And if you take this paper cup and you put buckshot in and weigh it, you get one weight. You bring it to the rim. If you put it in, and let's say that we have three paper cups and they represent three different racial groups, you pour some in, you fill it to the rim. Okay, if you do this and shake it and settle it down, then put a little more in, which is what happened for those for the paper cups representing whites. If you do that, then you put it on the scale, it's going to be a little heavier than the one where you just poured it in and didn't shake it around so that the spaces were taken up and things settled. So there were things that people did that were false science that were meant to enforce racial superiority. I sound like a historian. I'm not. I'm a retired English professor, but I do write. And I do a lot of research, and I put away between 70 and 100 books a year on all kinds of subjects. And I have, although it's getting worse as I get older, I have a very good memory. So I mean, I'm seeing a synthesis in all these things as
I still say there's some correlations here about how things were 150 years ago and how difficult it is to shake them. And I see a lot of this in people who are supposed to protect the society mm-hmm. feel about those they protect. If you ask two people, you can ask any person basically, and these people mostly sit on juries because juries are primarily made up of white citizens.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard for them basically, as they say, to convict a policeman because the fact that white people generally, even though there are some white people who have been themselves brutalized by cops or been hassled by cops, particularly young people, been hassled by them, still tend to think that the police are there to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
Black people, on the other hand,
have a different relationship.
Black people don't tend to see the police as their friends. They tend to see the police as mainly enemies, and that the police in the community more or less is an occupying force. The sad thing about it is many black police have taken on this same rather blue culture,
yes.
that even people who look exactly like them, primarily maybe even in the same situation, socioeconomic situation, are the enemy, are criminals, are prostitutes or pimps mm-hmm. or whatever, are drug dealers, and they look exactly like that person.
Yes.
But they don't see it that way.
And they don't see it that way, and that's, you know, the talk that every black parent has with his, primarily with his sons, but daughters mm-hmm. also, about how to behave when the police stop
uh-huh.
and so forth. Because my son is a police officer, I've had a different variation of the talk
mm-hmm.
so that you continue to see the humanity
mm-hmm.
in the people that you have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
They will do things that horrify you, but you
mm-hmm.
cannot lump people together and assume based mm-hmm. on particular characteristics what somebody is. Now, where my son is in Florida, I don't know. There are a lot of black people in his town, which is Melbourne, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of white people also. And we have a lot of black cops. We have more black cops on our police force here than he has on his police force.
Well, what I was going to say, though, like here, if you look back to the 40s, 50s, even 60s, when segregation in housing was mm-hmm. very prevalent, you find even though you could be a college professor, I could be a radio talk show host or whatever.
We live on the same street.
We all had to live
with someone who was a sanitation worker and somebody who worked at the post office.
Some people who were depths of depravity.
Yes.
And so you had everyone was lumped together. We couldn't pack up and move to a different, I mean, and I think these are legacies that still hang over because many, say, people who have a history of poverty still live in the same way and in the same more
yes.
or less lifestyle. But that was all police see. I used to, when Loretta Renford was alive, bless her heart, she was very active in going after police brutality and police misconduct. And at her suggestion, I went down several times and sat in city court,
mm-hmm.
people coming in. And what I noticed myself is most of the people coming in, and not all of them, of course, but I would say certainly 80% were all black.
Mm-hmm.
And the 20% left over were all white, but they were usually white people who were obviously working class or below
poor.
Even mm-hmm. the lower working class, and the same black. But the people who were in judgment were all white,
mm-hmm.
even down to the stenographers. Certainly all the lawyers that were walking in and out of there. The judges were all there. And any of the court people, anybody there who's in any position of authority whatsoever or not, they did not look poor, and
no.
they certainly were not any other color but white.
That brings up the issue that I have said for years, that race is frequently a mask for the truth, which is class. We have a class
mm-hmm.
system in this society.
Mm-hmm.
And the
could that be held over from colonial times with the British?
Oh, my, that British class system, which everybody loves Downton Abbey, but that's a
mm-hmm.
that is a fully realized manifestation of class and how
mm-hmm.
it interacts in Britain. And we have a class society here. Every society has classes. I mean, I know I've mentioned on your show before
mm-hmm.
The caste system in India. And while it's outlawed some years back, a few years, I don't know, 7-8 years ago.
Mm-hmm. There were the Untouchables, I think.
Well, the Untouchables were the lower class, the lowest mm-hmm. caste that people could not deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But you come from different castes for different things. And there was a case where as urbanization increases around the world, classes get mingled
mm-hmm.
more. They mix together more. And there was a case where this young man and young woman fell in love with each other, mm-hmm. and they were from different castes in a mm-hmm. society that traditionally dealt with arranged marriage, mm-hmm. and they wanted to be together, and their families from different castes would never have interacted with each other, but mm-hmm. they got together, the parents and siblings and so forth, mm-hmm. they got together for the son and the daughter who were very much in love with each other, mm-hmm. and they took them to the roof of their apartment building and threw them off. So the cast mm-hmm. could cooperate in a double homicide,
mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. which, and that shows you something about humanity, and it's not just white Americans. It's a very human thing where you have a group you want to belong to, and mm-hmm. what we have to do is expand the group. We have to understand that. And in terms of America, when we talk about class, and race is an aspect of class mm-hmm. because the poverty rates among people of color are higher than among people who are not of color. But you still see the same thing. The deck is stacked against the poor every way you turn.
If we suddenly tomorrow, every black person in the United States disappeared, there were absolutely mm-hmm. no black people here. They would have to find somebody to hate.
And they would. Mm-hmm. And they would find somebody in housing projects, people who didn't have money, who mm-hmm. were white. Mm-hmm. They would find somebody who's trying to get to work in a piece of a car mm-hmm. That's falling apart and gets a parking ticket or a moving violation and can't pay it. And then they get farmed off to one of these companies that helps collect the money from them. Mm-hmm. And they end up with a $50 ticket that turns into $2,000 of debt and maybe 30 days in jail at a cost of $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
So you take a $50 ticket that couldn't be paid and you turn it into $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 worth of mm-hmm. of debt. Or penalty or something,
mm-hmm.
that's insane. That doesn't happen to the middle class. If I go out of here, out of this radio station right now, and I get a $50 ticket, mm-hmm. I'm going to cuss and I'm going to be mad about it, but I'm going to pay it and it's going to be out of my hair.
Mm-hmm.
But people who can't pay it
mm-hmm.
end up getting caught up in a system that just magnifies their problems mm-hmm. geometrically. And that's what it means to be poor in America. You know, you talk about, look at payday loans.
That's what a ripoff that is.
That is. Well, sure, we'll give you $100 till payday, but you'll have to give us $150 back. Well, gee, mm-hmm. my paycheck's only $200.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I can just give them $100 back. Well, you can give us $100 back, but you're going to owe us another $100 next time you get paid. And the next mm-hmm. thing you know, they end up owing a tremendous amount of money mm-hmm. to a fly-by-night lender.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I need to borrow $50 and I have a credit card, I'll mm-hmm. take my credit card, spend my $50, and then I'll pay my credit bill and I get paid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference between being poor and being middle class. And mm-hmm. I have I'm not going to reveal that because
mm-hmm.
I have something I might be working on
mm-hmm.
To address this, and I don't want to put that out just yet. But so you if you have a situation like that, or you have the rent-to-own things
that
where
another thing.
You take a $500 refrigerator and you end up paying $1,500 for it or $3,000 for it over.
That's because
mm-hmm. it happens to the poor.
And that's where these rent-to-own places are usually located.
They victimize. Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell when you're in the inner city. If you go down, if you're in an inner city somewhere in this country, first you see Martin Luther King Boulevard, as Chris Rock says, or
mm-hmm.
Martin Luther King Avenue, you know you're in the hood.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start seeing bail bond outfits,
mm-hmm.
payday lenders,
mm-hmm.
Rent-to-own places, and
mm-hmm.
you know you're dealing with the poor and the people who prey on the poor.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes the issue of class. And if black people disappeared tomorrow, there would be a sufficient number. If all the black people in America tomorrow were middle class or above,
mm-hmm.
there would be a sufficient number of poor whites
mm-hmm.
that this practice would be transferred onto them exclusively, and they would still be victimized paying these exorbitant rates mm-hmm. and getting caught up.
But if you throw in race, you still have the
yes.
have the protection of a white skin.
Sometimes you do. And that's very much the case. There is a thing called white privilege.
Yes,
and that's the presumption of humanity if
mm-hmm.
your skin is white.
Mm-hmm.
Some research studies have shown that young black people are perceived as older than they are
mm-hmm.
by whites.
Mm-hmm.
And you take a look at the little boy in Cleveland.
12 years old, yeah.
12 years mm-hmm. old, playing with a toy gun,
mm-hmm.
and he gets shot dead by the police who roll up on him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the cop said, "We said put down the gun." I've looked at the video on that, and there's
mm-hmm.
no audio with it. but the car rolls up, and you remember how we used to do in gym when we're counting 5 seconds, one potato, two potato?
Yeah.
It's like one potato, and the kid's down.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't really time for him to process a put down the gun command.
He wouldn't probably have even thought about it like
because
that.
Because he's a child,
mm-hmm.
and his brain isn't finished developing yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that won't happen for another 12, 13 years for this kid, but he'll never get there because the cop perceived him as older, bigger, and more dangerous than he actually
was. And also
was.
The cop had a history, too.
And that particular cop did have a history. That's absolutely true. And that goes to another issue with policing. You need to find people who have good judgment, people who...
But what got me in that particular case is this man, they said, had been investigated, looked at his previous personnel files, whatever. Why would he have been hired by the Cleveland police? Well, he was fired from the Cleveland police, but he was hired by this smaller agency.
Right. I couldn't tell you why that particular guy was hired, but I know that's an issue. I told you I had a ride along with my son, Sergeant, recently. Okay. I liked his sergeant a lot. I won't give his full name, but he's white, and we talked as we were riding, and he talked about a time when he first moved to that area.
Mm-hmm.
He had a black friend. This was many years ago, and they were in the car together, and they got stopped by the police.
Mm-hmm.
And the officer said, "What are you doing with him?"
Mm-hmm.
As if to say, because a white man and a black man have a friendship.
Mm-hmm.
That there must be something wrong with the white man who's doing it. It must be a criminal activity.
Mm-hmm.
And so later, when he joined the police department, he actually got to see that same officer.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and it bothered him, he said, because some of these old guys need to go.
Mm-hmm.
This is an issue when they make the assumption of criminality on the part of blacks.
Mm-hmm.
If you're white and you, let's say you're smoking pot. I mean, blacks are 10% of the country's population. But I don't know the precise percentages, but I know they are misrepresented.
They certainly are.
Overly represented say, being in prison for marijuana. You know, if
and
you're a white kid,
they're...
it's like, oh, I know your dad. I've patronized his hardware store or whatever, and you need to give me that and go home. You black kid over there, you're smoking some pot, come with me.
And you got a record, it's like a felony charge.
Yes,
but the same thing because I had a guy that's been on my show a lot. I like him. He's a young guy with a young family, and when we were out, he said the best thing to do when I'm out with different friends, and I tell them, say nothing and let me be the one sitting in front and doing the talking. It'd be a lot easier on everybody if it's just me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, because they're not going to arrest me or do anything to me. He said, they'll do some, but you, it'll be something different. And this is a young white man.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I tell, and he's around a lot of, because he's very active politically and he's socially active, rather, by social, I mean in union activities and different other things. And he was very upfront about it. He said, and we're out together, I tell them, first, don't say anything, but maybe not even be, but let me be the one that's up front of doing the talking, because they're not going to do anything to me.
Right.
Now, that I don't know if most white people would even think about or know that. And
no,
he also had a
white
who was from the Dominican Republic.
Right. But you don't have to think about that. And that's the thing. In America, and I've said this before, I've said this in print, I've said it on your show before, there are people and other people.
Mm-hmm.
People are white, other people are not.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the perception.
Well,
I told you about
Barack Obama. Who that? Barack Obama was hounded with the likes of Donald Trump. I think he is
the sleaziest,
ugly
an idiot.
Person. He really is. You know, but
and
isn't
he, but
it?
But he needs to take that bag of
Ted Cruz. Wasn't he born in Canada?
Yeah, Ted Cruz was born in Canada.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's kind of like, I think he said his mother, I think, was an American. His father was Canadian, something like that. Anyway, he was.
His father was Cuban.
His father was Cuban. Now, you know, so what? Barack Obama's mother was white.
Yeah.
And his father was from Kenya. So this makes a whole big, but nobody, who's asked Ted Cruz for his birth certificate?
Actually, a few liberal pundits are pushing that. That'll be an issue later for him.
Mm-hmm.
For him. Ted Cruz scares me for another reason.
He scares a lot of people for other reasons.
Well, I mean, was it against Obamacare? he was trying to do the filibuster, and he was reading Green Eggs and Ham,
yes,
which is a book about trying something before you condemn it.
He
totally missed the point. Try it before you condemn it. He missed the point of Dr. Seuss's wonderful book. And I have to say, Green Eggs and Ham is one of my 10 favorite books. Absolutely love it.
And he was busy. He was going on like that. And I think it went over his head and several other people's heads as well.
Yes.
The meaning of what the book was talking about.
And that's another issue in terms of the legacy in this country. Again, there's a legacy of racism. There's a legacy of classism.
Mm-hmm.
There's a legacy of sexism. You think you've heard sexism?
Actually, wait till Hillary starts. Yeah,
it's gotten better in many areas, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But that it has gotten better doesn't mean it doesn't have a legacy or a history of those kinds of behaviors. Mm-hmm. And I think you'll see them come out. You'll see them come out during this forthcoming election. Hillary, all the racist stuff that came out to bother Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Just hold your horses. All the sexist stuff is going to come out to bother Hillary. Now, you can complain about Hillary's policies and things that she's done, and you can make legitimate complaints about those things. Hillary Clinton is no angel. But in the absence of specifics, which people are not looking for, Hillary will be demonized in such a way.
I'm not sure, and I've been a lifelong Democrat for a while. I'm not so sure if I'll vote for Hillary or not.
Right. I understand that.
My big reason is, I don't like coronations. I don't think that you hear policies and you don't flesh out ideas, you don't flesh out where people are going unless there's some kind of competition. I'm talking about within
the Democratic Party,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. I would have rather seen Elizabeth Warren get in there because she'd have certainly been a challenge to Hillary.
And well, if nothing else, would have pushed her left. I love Elizabeth Warren. She is terrific.
You know, or did something. But, you know, this idea of there's only two families in the United States that deserve to run the show, either the Bushes or the Clintons. You know, I mean, what are you going to do? You know, as by the time her mother gets to her 8 years, you know, Chelsea will be big enough to run for president. Then by the time Chelsea gets through with her 8 years, you know, her daughter Margaret will be ready to run, you know, whatever.
You do realize that our embrace of kings may be encoded in our DNA to some extent. Seriously, if you think about this, human history is rife with kings. We decide as a group there's somebody who's worth more than we are, and we will follow. And the reason is, and I've cited before, and it's mentioned in the Colin Wilson book, The History of Murder, which you know, is certainly a book on my shelf as a mystery writer, that leadership appears in humans and in nature at a rate of about 20%. You take a look at a pack of wolves. Of five wolves, there'll be one wolf in charge. One wolf will be the alpha.
But then again, there also has to be a situation, too.
Let me just finish, though. I wanted to say that we have used king imagery or royal imagery for everything, whether it's for religion or advertising.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Prince of Peace.
Mm-hmm. Okay. King of Kings.
We have the King of Kings. Mm-hmm. We have the Queen of Mean.
Mm-hmm.
We have the King of Used Cars. We embrace royalty in many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of families being dynastic is not unusual for us. And the thing is, usually when you looked at the history of kings, you find people who have been weakened by intermarriage and other stuff, and so they're nuts or they're frail or somehow not the
but
best of humanity, but we embrace this because we think it's a religious thing.
Putting some brakes on kings, witness the Magna Carta.
Yes.
You know, it was probably the first time that there was some brakes put on a king.
Probably not the very first time, but it's probably the first documented time in Western culture that you had a king who, you know, many people forget
Magna
that
Carta
the Pope,
put the foundation
the Pope,
of democracy here,
who
basically.
Was essentially the earthly representative of the King of Kings, the Pope, sent a letter revoking the Magna Carta. Nobody recalls that. It's one of those things that since the Magna Carta's in the news quite a lot lately.
And of course, the Pope, the papacy royalty, had all its own problems too.
Yes.
And who was that? The Borgias, of course.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot going on in those situations.
As Lord Acton said in the 17th century, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts
absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So you and Lincoln said that also. If mm-hmm. we swing this back to Lincoln, one of my favorite Lincoln quotes is, almost any man can stand adversity. If you want to test a man's character, give him power,
mm-hmm.
Which is very true. And that leads us mm-hmm. back to Lincoln. I was thinking when we talked about Lincoln and the 150th anniversary of his passing, I was thinking—
It just reminded me of so many different things. I guess I was thinking about it in terms of things that, like a legacy, not Lincoln's legacy, but things that seemed not to have changed that much in 150 years. I'm talking about attitudes, particularly racial attitudes.
Right. Then let's talk about Booth's legacy.
Oh, God, he was, didn't really realize, well, what was he, 26 or 27?
27, yes.
Years old. Even that age, he might have been a brilliant actor, but he was a jackass.
He was, and he also was somebody who visited prostitutes a fair amount, and he I don't know if his autopsy noted anything like that, but it's entirely possible he was suffering from syphilis as well. But his sensibilities.
Does syphilis have any physical manifestations?
Usually, if you've had it for a long time, you get to paresis, which will affect the brain and the nervous system tertiary.
He would
have been a little young for that. It does have some physical manifestations, but those are usually later in life. But
yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, they wouldn't have been able to detect it anyway.
No. But that said, Booth, as the first successful presidential assassin, had characteristics that other assassins and other people who have not been assassins have manifested. Grandiosity, a sense of self-importance, a belief that they're right over all others. Being the outlier, the person who is so far out from the crowd that he is exceptional. And those things have manifested, and maybe even madness to some extent. Other presidential assassins.
Certainly his racism was almost beyond the pale.
Yes. Yes. His racism was profound. His obsession with Lincoln was profound. But you find that all the successful presidential assassins have had some kind of obsessive grasp, and the even the unsuccessful assassins. I mean, you take a look at Charles Guiteau, who killed James Garfield. Guiteau was thoroughly insane, and he had been a member of the Oneida colony in the 19th century communist movements, and they're not communists in the terms of Marx, but communes, communal living, was a rage at one point. And John Humphrey Noyes, in the mid-1800s, set up a colony in Oneida, New York, where all the men and all the women were considered married to each other. And they had complex marriage and complex sexual practices. Charles Guiteau, who shot Garfield in 1881, was a member of the Oneida colony. His name was Charles Guiteau, but his nickname was Get Out. He was so creepy, by the time he shot Garfield, to have been influenced by syphilis, but he was mad. He thought he should be the ambassador to France. He thought Garfield slighted him by not answering his letters. He said God told him to kill Garfield, so he was the loner.
It's amazing how God is always telling all these different people
things. Yes. I mean, he says, God told me to do this. That's not what he said to me last night. But so, I mean, Garfield was, or Guiteau rather, was out there and the loner. The same for Leon Czolgosz, who assassinated William McKinley here in Buffalo. He had stalked McKinley a bit, and I recount, actually.
Didn't he say he was an anarchist?
He was an anarchist, but
anarchist is not such a bad thing. I've seen a lot of people.
A lot of anarchists in the early anarchist movement were bomb throwers and so forth. And Emma Goldman, who tried to have an intellectual basis for anarchy, was, I believe, Czolgosz had a thing for her. And my novel Blackbird Rising, which is about blacks in Buffalo at the time of the Pan American Exposition, had an extensive subplot on Czolgosz, McKinley's assassin. And when the book was being prepped, the editor said, too many subplots, we need to cut some things out. So I cut that out. But the story, An Assassin's Tale, was published in another book, an anthology called Wicked, it dealt with my perception of Czolgosz's his fascination with Emma Goldman and his particular search for meaning. Lee Harvey Oswald, another case of the loner, the outsider. Giuseppe Sangara,
who tried to... Lee Harvey Oswald was basically... I think in terms of Lee Harvey Oswald is more or less... manipulation. And I think
he may have been manipulated.
Yes. And I think, of course, and J. Edgar Hoover was terrible.
J. Edgar Hoover is absolutely terrible. I do not think, however, now, whether or not there was a conspiracy for the Kennedy assassination is certainly something that has been debated, and nothing I say here today will end the debate.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of the second shooter and the magic bullet, some of those things have been put to rest by science. For example, let's talk about the magic bullet a minute. The bullet that hit Kennedy in the back and emerged from his throat and then took a sharp right turn and hit Governor Connally in the seat in front of him. That bullet didn't take a sharp right turn. People who make that diagram saying it took a sharp right turn did not look at the car that they were riding in. They were riding in a limousine.
This bullet had a mind of its own.
No. They were riding in a limousine which had jump seats. So Connally's position was not directly in front of the president the way he would have been in a traditional car seat. It was a limousine jump seat. And if you've ever been in a family car at a funeral and you know that jump seat is pressed in closer, and then Connally was turning at the time the bullet was fired so that the bullet didn't turn to hit Connally. The bullet had a fairly straight path. It took a slight, not a sharp right turn, but it angled it because it hit part of Kennedy and shifted from the impact, and Connally was turning. And so if you consider all those things, the bullet trajectory is perfectly plausible for the single bullet. People said he couldn't have gotten off those three shots in 4.5 seconds, you know, bolting in the bullet into place in each case. Well, nobody starts to shoot somebody and waits to chamber the bullet until he's ready to fire. The first bullet is always chambered. Then when you pull the trigger, you have to chamber the next two bullets. And if you consider the first bullet was chambered, the time is perfect for having the second two bullets chambered within the space recorded for the shots. I mean, so I think science has put to rest the idea of another shooter. Now, whether there was a complex conspiracy that involved Oswald, there may have been some people involved paying Oswald, supporting him, what have you. But I will say this, one of my favorite quotes is Ben Franklin, who said, three can keep a secret if two are dead. And a complex conspiracy that complex, there have been several books written about it.
I suppose this what makes me feel that that's a plausible explanation is Jack Ruby. I find his interjection into that thing was a little bit too pat, too there. You know, he was just, oh, I've got to kill this man because he killed Kennedy. I just can't believe that Jack Ruby had that much type of, I don't know if patriotism is a type of word or outrage maybe.
Well, let me ask a question. Whenever somebody is assassinated... And there's that kind of circumstance, there's almost always a let's get him. When Leon Czolgosz was in the Buffalo jail,
but it's,
after
it's
shooting
silence,
McKinley, there was a mob that wanted
to... Oswald never got... Then Charlie never got to find out anything because he was dead. He was silent. That was gone.
Yeah. But let me just say this. The whenever somebody commits an assassination like that, there's always a mob willing to do it. The inefficiency of Ruby, quote-unquote, being sent to kill Oswald, it's astonishing. Oswald was being led out of the jail. If you knew Oswald was being led out of the jail and you wanted to silence Oswald, the best way to do it would have been from some distance away with a high-powered rifle, not close up like that. I think Ruby was angry and confused, and I don't think he had a story to tell. Now, he may have had some, and he probably did have some mafia connections and some other things, but I don't think Ruby was sent to...
The mob there was rather outraged. They had done Kennedy
in Chicago. Sam Giancana
they had done,
absolutely.
And, you know,
and Bobby Kennedy came after them, so they were angry.
So they could have. So I tend to believe that there could have been something.
I'm not saying there's no conspiracy for that. I'm saying there's no second shooter, number one. And I'm saying the Ruby connection is not convincing to me because I'm going to send a guy down there to kill Oswald to keep him from talking. Of course, what's to keep the second guy from talking and the third guy?
But what if they couldn't find anyone that could do that? I mean, he was well guarded. He was inside the prison. So, and, you know, he was being led. He was in a building when he was shot as well. So it would have had needed somebody that had been pretty close. Ruby was right on top of it because Ruby had access.
Ruby had access. Absolutely. That I don't think that means that Ruby was part of a conspiracy. Now, he may have been. I will certainly entertain that possibility. But I think there would have been more efficient ways of doing it without having somebody go down for it. Because the question is, who do you guarantee who won't talk? If I've killed somebody, and let's take a look at James Earl Ray, who shot Martin Luther King. He maintained, I didn't do it, I didn't do it. Well, he was a convicted felon, but he had a passport, and he was able to get out and go to England where he was arrested. I think somebody sponsored him. I don't think there was another shooter or anything like that in his case. I think there might have been people who paid him to do it. Said, you know what, this N is getting too powerful. We will, you know, if somebody can take him out, we'll get a payday. And I think that may have happened. Now, many times people maintain their innocence to the end. There was a case some years ago where a guy maintained his innocence in a rape murder, I believe it was, right through lethal injection. And then somebody did a DNA test afterward and said, yeah, he did it. His DNA was the one that was there. So I think James Earl Ray did shoot King, and he did have that, he did deny it because it
well, even the King's family basically had doubts about his about him doing certainly doing it alone.
Doing it alone. And I have doubts about his doing it alone. I mean, I don't know who the conspirators might have been, business people or what have you. But in the case of, like I say, with Jack Ruby, I think it's, you know, if you were trying to clean up a mess and keep somebody silent, you don't have somebody do it who's going to be arrested because what is his motivation to keep silent at that point and say, well, maybe they'll threaten his family or something like that. Well, he's in an environment where people can loosen his tongue one way or another. That's why that doesn't quite click for me. Now, I don't think Ruby did it as part of a conspiracy because I think there would have been more efficient ways to do it. You realize that Kennedy was shot with a high-powered rifle because people didn't anticipate it would happen, just like the airliners hit the World Trade Center towers because people didn't anticipate
Oswald
it happened.
That Oswald had, wasn't that some sort of old kind of almost obsolete
Mannlicher
weapon?
Carcana. It was an older Italian model, but it was not obsolete. It obviously, you know, was a decent enough rifle to do the job. And the thing is, Oswald tried to get away with it, as Booth tried to get away with it.
Well, Booth was shocked. Booth thought that he would be hailed as some kind of conquering hero.
Him a mad murderer.
Well, because mainly,
broke his heart.
Well, yeah, but mainly because the South probably recognized a lot more than Jack Ruby that he had set them back for God knows how long.
Yes and no.
Do you ever wonder what would have happened sometimes if Lincoln had lived? Before you answer, I have to tell people, we've been talking this morning with Gary Earl Ross, as you see, quite an interesting, intelligent person. Gary is a professor emeritus from SUNY, Equal Opportunity Equal Educational Opportunity Center.
So come down and, you know, take
I want to know what
classes.
You're doing. What are you doing now? We've only got about 2 minutes left. And I want to find out what you're doing now. What are you
right
up
now,
to?
I'm
other than traveling all over South America.
I'm writing a mystery novel set in Buffalo. Great cities have great fictional private eyes, and we don't have one. So I'm trying to give Buffalo Gideon rhymes. I'm working on a novel. I've written and published a few short stories, sold a few short stories since I've retired. I've directed a couple plays since I retired. I've written a play that I directed, and we talked about that, The Guns of Christmas, which got very good reviews. My play, The Mark of Cain, which won a competition in Bend, Oregon some years back, will be done in Buffalo next season.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we don't have a date yet, but I'll be directing. And it's you know, I've been
busy.
I've wanted since I was 10 years old to write full time and engage in the creative life, and I teach. I'm teaching a creative writing course at one local college right now, and
Are you
I taught
one of those
one last
poor,
at another college.
what do they call
adjunct?
Them? Adjunct professor.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I'm the guy you want for an
adjunct. Disgrace, you know.
I'm
really, what they pay, you know.
Yes.
Honestly,
I don't mind making a couple thousand dollars for a semester to teach a course because I have a pension. So I'm the guy you want who's in his field. I just have conditions. No more basic or remedial English. Nothing 101. No. I mean, I spent my professional life doing courses like that. So now I will teach only three different courses, either general creative writing or fiction writing or playwriting.
And I'll to teach more or less advanced students?
To students who want to write. That's and, you know, and then also I only teach those classes on Tuesday and Thursday. Do not come to me for Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I am not working like that ever again. I'm done with the full-time side of things. So so I'm doing that, and I do have an ongoing writing workshop at Just Buffalo Literary Center where a number of writers come to try out their work, and we work through things. So that's I'm up to.
I think that gives a person a sense of accomplishment that they've achieved something when they can do that. When you're finally doing something that you might really want to do.
That I've waited since I was 10 years old to do.
Just to do, you know, and I think that's really important too. For most people.
My blood pressure's great. I'm pretty much the happiest I've ever been in my life. Kids are grown and gone. Yeah, healthy grandchildren. I'm delighted to be where I am in my life right now. I cannot complain.
We have to. What would you say now if you could project yourself from then? What would you think? How would the United States be now? How different would it be now if Abraham Lincoln had have lived?
I think it would be dramatically different. Lincoln did not want to punish the South. He, given his physical characteristics, his health may have taken him away not long after he died. If you look at the first picture of him in his administration and the last picture before
he
died, the man looked like death warmed over.
Really.
Had he lived, though, with malice toward none, he would have tried to rebuild the country. But what happened after that, with Reconstruction and the carpetbaggers, and then Rutherford B. Hayes coming in and making a deal with the Southern representatives, since it was the first election thrown into the House, that we'll pull federal troops out of the South, you can do what you want. And you had the rise of Jim Crow, the Klan, and some other things at that point. I think the country would have been better off. And then Thomas F. Dixon Jr. and his novels, including The Klansman, which was turned into Birth of a Nation, celebrating its centennial this year.
Yes.
Those
and you know, Wilson was the one that was sitting, had that viewed in the White House. He was quite a racist himself.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Woodrow Wilson is a whole other story. Yeah. He said Birth of a Nation is the first feature film shown in the White House, and Woodrow Wilson, a historian, praised it as writing history with lightning. And one of the issues that we've had, I used to do scavenger hunts with my research students, having them find things before the internet. And one question was, name the first feature film shown in the White House. And one student one year called the White House and asked, and the White House switchboard official answer was The Jazz Singer, 1927 with Al Jolson. No, they're trying to deny history, and it was Birth of a Nation in 1915.
Well, we've got one more minute left to go in our show, and I want to thank Gary for being my guest this morning and talking about this. Gary, of course, is with me on television quite a bit, too.
Yes.
And so we're going to take some of these issues because I think, again, if you don't know your history, you are bound to repeat it.
Absolutely. And read. Read to your children. Get your children to read. Expose yourself to the written word because reading makes you smarter.
And that's it for me this morning. I want to thank Gary again for being my guest. I'm your host, Mary Davis. Stay with the station throughout your day.
You've been listening to The Mary Davis Show. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to Mary Davis, 500 Corporate Parkway, Suite 200, Amherst, New York, 14226.